Hi, I'm Vernon Trollinger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Craig Thomas, OD, optometrist at First Eye Care in Dallas, Texas. Where did you grow up?
I grew up at several places. Started in Houston, Texas. I was born there, stayed there till I was 8 years old. We moved to Dallas, stayed in Dallas for 2 years, then moved to Los Angeles. Stayed in Los Angeles for 5 years. Started high school in Inglewood High School, as a matter of fact. My mother taught in Compton, if you've heard the Straight Outta Compton kind of thing. But we were there during that whole phase. Stayed there for 5 years, then came back to Dallas. I finished high school in Dallas and then went off to Houston to go to college. Stayed in Houston for 6 years going to college. I did undergrad in 2 years and then 4 years of optometry school and moved back to Dallas 33 years ago when I graduated.
What did your parents do?
So my parents, my mother's a teacher, so she's taught junior high school for 40 years. My dad had several jobs, which is why we moved. He was self-employed for a while and actually ran a liquor store and a sporting goods store. He tried to be entrepreneurial and eventually took a management job. His main job, but what he finished up and retired at for like 20 years, was as a purchasing agent for Atlantic Richfield, ARCO. So he had a nice, so they were, both of my parents, college degree, nice middle class American lifestyle. We had a nice house, had a swimming pool, so I wasn't poor. But I wasn't rich. I started working when I was 15. I started working at Burger King, so I could have my own money and do my own stuff. When I was in high school, I spent all my money being a motocross racer. So I used to race motorcycles. So I did that for 3 years, then went off to college.
Now, as I recall, your admission into optometry school wasn't as smooth as others. How did you get into optometry school? I think you said you after you were rejected.
I was indeed. So I became aware of optometry as a profession while an undergrad at the University of Houston. Went over toward the facility, thought it was kind of interesting, and thought I would give it a shot. I really wasn't too deep into it, but I said I wanted to be some kind of doctor, so I just kind of, I'll try this and see what happens. If I didn't get in, I was so young, I didn't really care. Cause I'd only gone to college for 2.5 years. So I applied, and did not get in. Wasn't, overwhelmingly disappointed because I was so young and I figured I'd just try again next year. But, I had all the minimum requirements. I had the GPA and all that stuff. So, I figured, okay, I'll just give it a shot. So I went and got a job. I went and got, cause I didn't have any money. So I went and became a full-time salaried restaurant manager at Burger King and started going to school part-time. So I went through the whole management training program, and like 3 days before the semester started in school, optometry school, I get a phone call that says, "Do you still want to go to optometry school?" And I go, "Yeah, I guess. Yeah, sure." yeah, what's going on? Yeah. And they said, "Well, show up Monday at 8 o'clock, I was like, "Okay." that's telling you, man. It was like I got the call Friday. So I showed up Monday at 8 o'clock, went through the orientation with everybody else. Everybody was new, so it wasn't no big thing. And after, a few days, once the kind of the dust settled, I went ahead and got a meeting with the associate dean that was in charge of admissions. And I went up there and I said, "Hey, man, it's not like I'm unhappy or nothing, but, I got this fancy rejection letter from you guys in the middle of the summer. And then I get a phone call 3 days before the school starts saying, "Do you still want to come? What's going on?" and he told me. Apparently they got to go through, compliance things with the government. They submitted their the first year class, they entered the students. And lo and behold, unbeknownst to somebody, they didn't have any minority students in the class. They didn't have any black students. Okay. So out of 104 people, they didn't have any black students. And apparently the federal government, doesn't like that, for good reason, probably. So they got all scary, apparently, and says, "Well, we got one or two guys that applied. We better get them in no matter what." And so I think I was on that short list. And when we started, there were four black guys in the class out of 104 students. I was the only one that finished. The other three flunked out, which is real common. So that's how I got in. Kind of, I don't want to say an afterthought. I don't want to say, a product of affirmative action or anything like that. Who knows? But that's how I got in. So I was, but I don't look negatively on it. I was good enough to get in. There was just guys better, I guess. So it didn't bother me. What did bother me is they assembled a class with no black people. I thought that was rinky-dink. so Yeah, and apparently if the federal government wasn't making them, they keep doing that nonsense. So then as an aside. So that's how I got in, you know, so it was no big deal.
You opened your first practice straight out of optometry school.
I bought a practice. So, yeah, so I fused in with him. So I was always, even as a kid, I knew I wanted to be some kind of doctor when I was probably 11, 12 years old. You know, I was a real science geek, chemistry sets for Christmas, the whole bit, you know. So I knew I wanted to be a doctor. And honestly, I did it because I wanted to make a lot of money. You know, I was driven by financial gain. So I said, okay, I'm going to be a doctor because I want to make a lot of money. As I grew older and older, I realized I liked being a boss, too. I learned that from my Burger King days. I like being in charge of stuff. So that guided me from the beginning. The profession is built on guys like me, private practice, regular guys. I always knew I wanted to end up being my own boss, being self-employed, having my private practice. I used to sit in the back of the classroom and actually daydream about it. I would draw pictures of my building and the building that I eventually would have. And it took me 8 years of being an optometrist before I started my building. So that was always, I knew what I wanted, you know. Man, less than 6 months after I started, the first Lens Crafters in Dallas opened up about a mile from my practice. So it was real tough in the beginning. First few years, man, it was tough. I almost thought I'd made a bad career choice. It's much harder than I thought. You know, you gotta be real good. You gotta be better than most, or you're not gonna be successful. This stuff's too hard to do. There's too much competition.
Well, along that line, you know, what is the biggest common obstacle for growing a practice?
Lack of access to medical panels. So let's say you're an optometrist. Let's say you're an optometrist in a modern state like Louisiana, where you could do laser surgery and all kind of wild stuff. But what if you can't get on the plans where the insurance pays for that? So what if you're in a town where 70% of the people are on Blue Cross, but when you apply to the Blue Cross plan, they say the panel's full, you can't get on. Or what if you do like what happened to me last year, where I hired a new associate specifically so I could cut my schedule back after working 33 years. And the demographic around my part of town is changing significantly, where 30-40% of my practice is now Medicaid, you know, a bunch of poor people, administered by the state, whereas Medicare is administered by the federal government. Well, the way the Medicaid program is here in Texas, and it's a common thing all around the country, the panels are closed because now they farmed it out to where Medicaid is not run by the state anymore. They farmed it out to these HMOs, you know, kind of contracted it out, and they're totally mercenary. So the HMOs and the managed care plans, they close the panels in a misguided attempt to save money. What they're doing is denying services to the clients. But they say, you know, their position is that the less providers we have, the less money we're going to spend. You know, and they might be true, but, you know, you're balancing your budget on my back and not yours. So I hire a new associate so I don't have to work 5 days a week anymore, and I want my new associate to see all the Medicaid patients, you know, where I'm not really making that much money, and let me stay free to see the cash patients and the patients with higher revenue. Well, they won't let my new associate on the plan. It absolutely destroys my ability to be competitive and to do what I want to do for my business. It's really tough, man. It's really tough. So now I'm barely, you know, barely covering her expenses. I mean, we had a meeting about it yesterday. She was there all day. I paid her $450. She saw 9 patients on Medicaid insurance. She generated $600 in gross income. You know, but I had to have support staff helping her, doing all kind of workups with the patients. I didn't make no money. No money. You know, I didn't lose no money, but I didn't make no money. You know, I'm in business to make money. You know, I'm not in business to pay Dr. Lee and break even. and so that's an example how that thing cripples me. So what if you're some new optometrist? You want to live in Buckhead, Atlanta, some fancy suburb. Okay, you heard that's where all the rich people are. So you go up to Buckhead, Atlanta. Okay, all the people that work there got 4 plans, Aetna, Cigna, United Healthcare, Humana. What if you can't get on those plans? So you'll see none of those medical patients. So if you listen, even if you're an optometrist, so you got the vision care, you got your VSP, Superior Vision, iMed, that kind of stuff. So that'll drive traffic into your office. But if that's the only thing you got, so you get the Superior Vision eye exam that pays you $50. The patient comes in, you see something wrong with them where you think they got some kind of disease. You you want to run some tests and figure out what's wrong with your patient, make some money on top of it, you're not on the plan. You got to send that patient out. So you just made $50, where the ophthalmologist or the optometrist that's been in practice for 15 years around you and was able to get on the plans where they shut the panels down, so now that doctor's getting ready to make your $400. So for a new man, it's really hard on the new grads. It's tough. It's real hard. That's why they all go corporate. So I'd say that's the biggest problem facing a modern optometrist in 2017, and particularly the young ones.
You have a direct, no-nonsense style. Does that help or hurt your practice?
Oh, it's a really positive thing for my practice. So I have a cult practice. My patients love me. You'll find that a common thread to many private practices that are extremely successful. You know, I mean, I know guys, man, making $5 million a year being optometrists. Okay, they're good at it. You know, and the first part about being good at it is you got to be friendly. Being friendly is about 85% of this stuff, you know, with the patients. If you're not friendly, if you don't understand that, if you're not good at it, you know, you're just not going to make any money. People, it's almost like a dog feeling fear. People can feel it when you're confident, when you're friendly, when you're outgoing, when you're personable, when you're polite, when you're courteous. Man, all that stuff makes a big difference in this business because it's so service-oriented, okay? So you know, you combine the friendliness, the outgoing personality, that's my nature because I'm a boss type A kind of guy. Some patients really like that. Probably 80% of my patients are black, 70-80%. A lot of black people, it's almost like I'm the preacher. They want their preacher to be successful. They want their preacher in a fancy car. They want their preacher to be wearing diamond cufflinks. Okay, when I get a new car, my patient, what kind of car you got, Doc? You know, you got one of them Jags. You know, I mean, they don't look at it like I'm making money off of them and wasting it. They look at me like, okay, I'm going to a successful doctor. That means I'm making good decisions. It makes them feel better. So when I bust up in there in an $800 suit and start talking some yak, because I'll go, like when I get back from New York, I said, you know, first patient on Monday morning. So you know I just get back from New York, right? I was doing some lectures for the eye doctors in the country. Oh, God, Thomas, you're so crazy. You know, they love it. They love it. So they know I'm a lecturer. They know I speak. They know I consult. They know I write, that I travel, you know, they know it because I don't hide it. It's part of the whole thing, part of my brand. And it's good and bad because it's not transferable. I can't, my associate got none of it. You know, I can't transfer the thing my patients feel about me to her. And they all still want to see me, you know, so it's been a challenge trying to convert people because I got a strong personality and, you know, either you like it or you don't. Most of the time, most people like it. I mean, I got a spoilage factor always of about 5%, whether I'm with patients or speaking. You know, I could go up to Wisconsin, man. There'll be 500, you know, kind of conservative white dudes in the crowd. You know, they might not be feeling me, you know. my joke's not funny up there. Whereas here in Texas, you know, I'm bringing down the house. It's a whole different vibe.
Why aren't there more black optometrists, do you think?
Oh, that's two or three things there. You got lack of awareness, probably the biggest thing. I was totally unaware until I went to University of Houston and would have been unaware if it were an optometry school sitting on the campus. My only exposure to eye doctors was in high school when I had my first eye exam, and that was at an ophthalmology practice. I personally have directed 10 students, 10 black students into optometry school in my career. So, I mean, I'm trying. But that's, you know, 10 out of 30 years. That much. But I got 10 people where I said, hey, you know, some 18-year-old kid in my practice getting some contacts. And I say, hey, you ever think about being an optometrist? And it's like, no, I never thought about that. And I'll sit and talk to them for 30 minutes. Okay. I've had 10 guys do that in 30 years, you know, where they applied, got in, became optometrists, all black students. So the first thing is the lack of awareness. The second, well, honestly, you know, and I can't prove it. And if I get into a fight with somebody, they'll make me prove it. You know, and it's like the black guy having to prove that he can't get a taxi in New York. Okay, all the black people know that. And, you know, and all you're going to do is piss me off if you make me try to prove it. I shouldn't have to prove that the sun's going to come up tomorrow. You know, I shouldn't have to prove that fire's hot. You know, I shouldn't have to prove that ice is cold. And I shouldn't have to prove that institutional racism exists in the Association of Colleges of Optometry. And it was very bad at U of H. Really, when I was there and afterwards, man, it was terrible. You could tell. Some guys, man, they were racist. Some of the professors. I mean, they would say stuff. They would do stuff. They'd treat you certain ways. And what would happen at U of H, which, you know, I can only speak to from personal experience, you know, my first story is one example. You know, so how are you going to make up an entry class of 104 people and everybody look the same? Okay? That means you ain't even trying. You don't even think about it. It's not important to you. So that the second thing is that the people that were making decisions, and still are to a degree, to a large degree, they don't care. None of them are black, and it don't mean nothing to them. I said, what if you guys wouldn't have let me in? Think of it, you know, this profession would have been different if you wouldn't have let me in. I mean, I've made a difference. I said, you don't look, and if you'd have looked at my history, where I'm working when I'm 15 and working three jobs trying to get an optometry school, I said, man, I'm like a Jamaican drug dealer, man. I got all kinds of stuff going on here. I said, you don't take any of that stuff into account. And all you're looking at is the GPA and the OCAT scores. I said, and so all you're going to get is a bunch of kind of automatons or guys that don't care about the profession, you know, and the guys that 2 seconds after they graduate, all they want to do is go work for some ophthalmologist and help that guy fight us legislatively. They don't get now you see, now you got me going.
I can tell.
Because it pisses me off, man. They don't take it into account. So you'll have some black kid, 18 years old, raised by a single mother, and he helping his three kids go through high school and not go to jail. Okay, well, he don't have as good of an OCAT score as some, you know, Vietnamese brainiac. Okay, they're not going to let him in. I got three doctors in my practice, my big, fancy $2 million practice. All the optometrists in my practice are black, but me and two other black optometrists. You got three black optometrists. I had four female black optometrists come up to hang out with us. So right at that one moment in time, I had seven black optometrists all in one spot together. That doesn't happen very often in this country, okay? So you got institutional hostility directed towards black people, and the result is the minuscule and disproportionately low number of optometrists that are black in this country and in schools. Every school I go to, there are eight of them in the past 4 or 5 years. You look on the walls, look at the classes, and there's never a class of more than 3 or 4 black students. And you'll have 35 Asian. You'll have more Mexican students now than black students. So that's the black thing to me is those things. Lack of awareness, some institutional racism, which is, again, if you say that, all they're going to do is they're going to get mad, go defensive, and try to make me prove it. I would say pull out the past 10 class pictures and count the percentage of black students in each class, and it's going to average single digits, sometimes 2-3%. That's all I got to say about that.
You do a lot of continuing ed lectures. What are the two biggest trends ODs should pay attention to?
My biggest thing right now is lecturing on amniotic membrane therapy. I've done probably 10, 12 lectures in the past year. It's growing rapidly, new technology, lots of clinical benefits, lots of financial benefits to the provider. That's probably the biggest thing to me. My next big opportunity to me, and what I started lecturing on, I've given two lectures on it already, is a different way of diagnosing and treating diabetic retinopathy. So I may see 8, 9, 10 patients a day with diabetes. It's a big deal in my part of town. So, what we do is we dilate the patient up, you look inside the eye, and you look for stuff you can see, some kind of hemorrhage, some kind of swelling, some kind of area of non-perfusion where the blood flow is messed up. You know, something that's visible looking inside the eye, generally with an ophthalmoscope or with a camera. So the whole way that we diagnose diabetic retinopathy is based on the observation of abnormality, okay? So that's what would be called a vasculopathy. So you've got an ophthalmic vasculopathy. Now, diabetic patients get vasculopathies all over the body. They get all kind of, you know, tingling in the toes and fingers and altered blood flow. So, you know, you can have general vasculopathy and you can have ocular vasculopathy. What you also get when you have diabetes is a phenomenon called neurodegeneration. And neurodegeneration is down at the microscopic level, cellular level, you know, structural damage that you can't see at all. But once the neurodegeneration starts, you start to lose your vision. You start to lose visual function. Traditionally, the way we measure visual function is by doing a refraction and obtaining the best visual acuity. So measuring a person's visual acuity or determine the visual acuity is a way to measure visual function. The second most common way optometrists do measure visual function is doing a threshold visual field test with a perimeter, some kind of 32 visual field or so on. So you can measure visual function with a refraction test. You can measure visual function with a visual field. Well, you can also measure visual function with an extended color vision test. You can also measure visual function with an electroretinography test. You can measure it with a VEP test. So the way you determine if a person has neurodegeneration is you have to measure the function of whatever body part it is. And if the function is decreased while the pathology is present, you put them together and say, well, you know, the visual function is decreased because the person has diabetes. Then therefore, if the visual function is decreased, it has to be some kind of retinal problem. That's diabetic retinopathy, even if you can't see it. So what I've begun to teach is that there's two kinds of diabetic retinopathy, the vascular kind we've been focused on for the past 50 years, and the neurodegenerative kind that I'd learned about 6 months ago. And the only way to assess and detect the neurodegenerative kind is to run a bunch of tests. You got to have some technology. You got to do extended color vision. You got to do curves. You got to do visual fields. And you can have this neurodegeneration even in the presence of 20/20 acuity. So now when we examine our diabetic patients, the first thing, and what we've been focused on like a laser beam, does this person have diabetic retinopathy, yes or no? Well, if you didn't see anything, you would say no. To me now, you can't make that determination without running some sophisticated diagnostic test and making sure there's no neurodegenerative type of diabetic retinopathy present. So that's my big thing now. I don't know if you know Paul Chouse. Me and Paul Chouse are going to do a lecture on this topic together at Vision Expo West in Vegas this year. And we're going to start hammering this thing hard because I think it's a whole new area. You know, so it's a growth opportunity. You're looking at it different. You're treating it different. You're intervening earlier. Dr. Chouse has developed with this company, Odd Promise, this DVS supplement formula designed specifically to keep the blood vessels healthy in patients with diabetes. So now I've begun to dispense that, to prescribe that, in addition to doing all these tests that I used to not do. So now, you know, a year and a half ago, I'd have a patient come in with diabetes. I'd dilate them up. They wouldn't see nothing. They'd have 20/20. I'd say, okay, you're normal. I'd send a report to the physician. He's normal. Now, even if that guy appears to be normal, I'm doing one or two sophisticated tests, either PERG or visual field or extended color vision, before I say that guy's normal. Because all I can say by looking at him is that he doesn't have the vascular component. I got to do some tests to see if he doesn't have the neurodegenerative component. So to me, that's going to blow things up. Guys, buy into this. You know, the patient that you've been looking at saying that's normal, sometimes now you're going to tell them that they got a problem. The patient that you used to blow off and try to show them a pair of glasses, now you're going to have a conversation about putting them on supplements. The patient you used to see on VSP and make $67.15, now you're going to build a United Healthcare and make $350 on a visit. It's totally different. That's my thing now, is trying to help guys understand that. And from a self-serving point of view, make it to where I'm not the only guy practicing like this, because it makes me look funny. You know?
How did your CE program come about?
To be honest with you, yet again, it had its genesis in the black thing. Okay, I'm a real racial guy. It's weird because I'm so light-skinned. It's like I'm overcompensating. But I've been going to, like I said, I've been practicing 33 years. And year after year after year after year after year after year, I'm going to 12 to 15, 16 hours of class a year, and not once in my entire optometric career did I have a class given by a black optometrist. Ever. And so, about 15 years ago, I was sitting at a meeting in Austin at the Texas Optometric Association annual meeting. I go every year. There was a guy giving a lecture, a guy named Peter Shaw McMinn. Nice guy, older dude. I'd never heard or seen him before. But I was looking through the program, looking at his credentials, and he was the chairman at that time of the AOA's Practice Management Committee. So, you know, he gave a class. It was a decent class. So I walked up to the guy after the class. I said, hey, man. I said, I have a complaint. He goes, what is it? I said, I've been going to optometry continuing education for the past 18 years, and not one time have I seen a black optometrist give a class. You're in charge of practice management for the American Optometric Association. Is there anything you can do about that? You know? And to this guy's credit, man, the instant I said that, he stepped back for a second and he said, you know, you got a point here. Let me see what I can do. And I said, okay, here's my name and number. He called me up a couple of months later and says, okay, here's what we're going to do. He says, you think you're good enough to speak? I go, yeah, absolutely. He says, all right, I want you to hang out with me. Let me see if you're good enough to do this stuff. And he took me under his wing for a year, and I was like a little chick. And wherever he went to speak, he carried me along with him and put me on the program. And that's how I got started, like spoon-fed, man, for a year. This guy just he just took care of me. So, I mean, I'm not, you know, we go to some big fancy meeting in Carmel, California. I'm getting, you know, they're paying for my flight, hotel. I go give a little one-hour class on specular microscopy. Man, you know, none of that would have happened without this guy. But I'm a much better speaker now than I was 15 years ago. I mean, probably 10 times better. But that's how I started. And then once I started it, you know, and got better at it, then, you know, I kind of started getting my own stuff going.
All you did was get up and ask a question.
Yeah, I forced the issue. And the guy, you know, to his credit, didn't blow me off. Didn't say get away from me. You know, he was conscientious and thoughtful and sat and thought about it for a second and said, you know, you have a point here, and I'm not gonna let this go. And he didn't. Peter Shaw McMahon. But he's my guy. He's the guy that got me started. Now I had to be good at it, or I wouldn't have been able to sustain it. But that's how I got started.
So what's something your colleagues don't know about you?
Man, I probably shouldn't say it. So I ain't gonna say it. Yeah, okay. They don't know I was a Burger King manager for 8 years.
Okay.
I would say I've been arrested, but then people start asking why.
Okay, why?
No.
Well, you just said. Okay. What's your guilty pleasure food?
Man, Bluebell ice cream. I eat a cup every night. Just like a crackhead.
Are they selling that again? I thought they had closed.
Oh, yeah, man. I was going through with everybody here in Texas, man. We were like, we had to go to get some methadone, man, while they had the Bluebell out. I mean, I grew up on that stuff, man. It's like drinking milk.
What's one thing you would change about optometry as it stands now?
Got to change the education. Got to increase the number of patient exposures and the variety of eye disease that the students are consistently exposed to. When they come out book smart, but they don't know nothing and they haven't done anything, and they can't compete against guys like me or any ophthalmologist, and it's the school's fault, and they know it and they don't care. Have you heard the phrase or the saying, never be the last eye doctor the patient sees before they go blind? That phrase has done more harm to our profession than any ophthalmological state association, any bad governor, anything at all. It's self-inflicted. So with that statement, when I was in optometry school, was pervasive. That attitude was pervasive. They would teach you to be scared. They teach you to not want to do stuff. They teach you to always refer to some ophthalmologist. They teach you to never take the first step. Always show deference. Always transfer liability. Never take charge. Never be the boss. Never be the final stop. That's what they teach in optometry school. If I was a teacher there, I'd be teaching these guys how to make $2 million a year. When I was an assistant adjunct professor, I would go down there every Saturday and we'd play a game show, The Price is Right. And I said, okay, I'm going to put a case up here. I want four contestants. You get up here. You know, whoever wins, you have a $100 bill. I pull out $100. So I'd say a 68-year-old lady with Medicare insurance, plus 4 keratitis, 20/30 best corrected vision, burning on the eyes in the morning. This is what you see with the slit lamp and ophthalmoscopy. How much is this case worth on one visit? And then I would let them go at it. Okay? And they'd be so stupid. So $100, $150. Oh, $275, you know, and the case to me is this $800 in my office. Stuff I'm going to do. And so it was always whoever got the highest would win the $100. I said, let me show you guys a different way to do this stuff. See, nobody's doing that kind of stuff. They're afraid to talk about money. They teach them to be scared. Even these four ladies that came into my office Tuesday, I almost threw a rock at one of them. So we're sitting there talking about the amniotic membranes. I'm telling her, hey, you know, I let them watch me do one. I said, now, you see, I just made $1,000 in 12 minutes. And they go, well, what if you get audited? I go, if I hear that one more damn time, I'm going to shoot somebody. What auditor abused optometry students when they were kids? It's almost lockstep, man. You could go anywhere in the country, and if you start talking about making money or filing an insurance claim, within 3 minutes, some knucklehead optometrist goes, well, what if you get audited? What if you get audited? And I'm like, just stop it. My God. You know, somebody stole your candy cane when you were 5 years old, you know? What is it with these? And they learn that stuff in optometry school. You learn to be stupid in optometry school. You learn to be scared in optometry school. You learn not to take responsibility in optometry school. You learn to not want to treat glaucoma in optometry school. You learn to try to charge extra for dilation in optometry school. No, we don't teach that to each other. Well, not out in the real world, because we know you can't survive like that. But 50% of our profession graduates with strike two by the time they put up their first shingle because of the knucklehead education they get. That's the biggest problem as far as the profession. The insurance is the biggest problem with the making money, but the biggest problem we got now is the professors in optometry school. That's my opinion.
Do you have any regrets?
That I didn't get a better education in the beginning, and it took me so long to figure it out. It shouldn't have taken me 8-9 years to figure out how to do this stuff. If I had to do it again, and I tell students this, rather than buy an existing practice and try to change the culture and mold it to the way you want it, which takes time, I would simply open cold from scratch and impress my will on my people from day one, as opposed to having to hire and fire and go through them and do it in over time, which is what you got to do when you buy a practice. So if I had to do it over again, I would simply start cold. And I blame my optometry school professors. They conditioned us to be afraid of that. They conditioned us to not go try to open cold. That the risk is too high. You're going to fail. It's better to go work at Lens Crafters for 3 years and save your money. It's better to go do this. It's opening cold is hard. You're going to fail. You don't do that. So I got so scared because I'm thinking, okay, these guys know what they're talking about. I said, man, I don't want to open a practice cold. All of my classmates that open cold are more successful than me, and I'm real successful.
Okay, our last question, and we inflict this on everybody. What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
Craziest? I bought a $100,000 Jaguar on a snap impulse decision. I mean, that ain't true. I never really thought about it. It was a weird deal. It was one Tuesday, and I came to work, and it was kind of it was really a life-changing event for me. My best friend, a guy named Mike Hammond, he was my local optometric mentor. He's a millionaire guy, had a nice ranch, made a bunch of money being an optometrist, and bought a bunch of real estate. I was like a puppy dog at his heel, man. I mean, he was my guy. He was my friend. You know, we'd go out to dinner together. We'd go to meetings together. He took me under his wing, you know, as a mentor. So he asked me to go to Las Vegas with him to some global contact lens conference or something. You know, this, and I'm like, man, you know, cause he asked me at the last minute. I said, Mike, you know, man, I got patience for the next few days, man. Next time I'll go next time. And I wanted to go. And he's like, okay, all right, no problem. I'll see you next week. So he goes to Vegas for the weekend, you know, and I would have been with him, you know, ordinarily. Well, Tuesday morning, I come in to work, and one of my opticians comes in and says, did you hear about Dr. Hammond? I go, what? What about it? He says, he got killed in a car wreck in Vegas over the weekend. I go, what? What are you? And, man, I broke down crying, boo-hooing. I mean, I didn't cry like that when my daddy died. I mean, it did, because the suddenness, the shock, you know, I mean, I just broke down. I broke down crying. Dropped to a knee. We started praying. And I couldn't even get myself together. I mean, I was just totally discombobulated. And so I called his wife. You know, she's crying. She told me what happened. He was in a taxi, and some drunk guy ran a red light and T-boned him, you know, killed him instantly. Okay. And I'm like, you know, when she told me that, I said, there's no way I would not have been sitting next to that guy. You know, there's no way he'd have been running around Vegas without me in a taxi. You know, we'd have been going to some titty bar or something. You know, we'd have been doing something. I'm like, you know, I'm thinking, I'm like, you know, number one, I would have been dead if I was with him. So, I mean, that kind of was messing with me. And number two, you know, now my best friend's dead, you know, over some humbug. And I was like, man. And so I'm thinking, my best friend just got $1 million cash in the bank, just died because he was some bull crap old taxi that got T-boned instead of his nice, big, giant, heavy four-door Mercedes that's built like a tank, you know. And I'm like, okay. So at the time, I had a Ford Mustang car. I just bought me a little Mustang trying to act like I was still in high school, you know, because I had a GTO in high school, so I like muscle cars. I got a Challenger now. So I'm thinking, you know, man, this little Mustang, you know, little bitty car, if I get hit by some big car, I'm dead, just like my friend. And I said, I'm going to buy me a safe car right now. And I just walked out the office that morning. I told my staff and said, hey, I got to go. I can't take it. You know, I've been crying. And I drove to the Volvo dealership thinking, you know, Volvo's got the safest cars made. I'm going to get rid of this muscle car. I'm going to turn myself into a librarian and drive a safe car because I'm not going to go out like my friend. So I spent the next couple of hours driving Volvos all around. And then I said, man, you know, and I sat there. I was sitting there in the dealership. I said, this is not me. You know, that's not what I do. I said, screw this. So then I drove down the street to the Jag dealership, and they had this XK8 convertible, and sapphire blue. And I just jumped in that bad boy, rolled around the block. I said, hey, man, how much is this car? He goes, $100,000. I go, here, take it. You know, so I throw that bitch off the lot right there. So I like, because it was big and fast. You know, it's a big, heavy car, the sports coupe, though, but it was real big. And so that was, you know, man, I woke up Tuesday morning, you know, going to work, and I drove home at 4 o'clock showing my wife, hey, look what I just got. So that was kind of a weird day. So that's how I bought my first Jag.
And you just pulled into the Jag lot because?
Because it was a Jag.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't like the Volvos. I couldn't see myself, my type A personality, boss guy, you know, kind of man about town kind of guy, you know, I can't drive no Volvo, you know, no matter what. I'd rather get T-boned, I guess. So I changed my mind. So, you know, that was a pretty big impulse purchase, you know, that I had no plan on making. But it was good, you know, I kept that car 5 years. Actually, I got another XK right after one. Then I said, man, because they break down, man, they're fragile. And I was spending $15,000 to $20,000 a year servicing that car. You know, I felt like I had a mistress. I'm like, this is crazy. So I'm driving my Challenger now, my Dodge Challenger. I love it.
Craig, it was great talking with you today. That's all the questions I got.
Okay,
for you.
Man. I tried not to say any cuss words.
Hey, thanks again.
Okay.
Take care.
Okay, thank you.